Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Bud Knight.
And I am Sir Ezra, the Watchful. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into chapter 29, Sansa 2 of A Game of Thrones. And in A World of Ice and Fire, we are discussing the fall of the dragon. And Robert Baratheon, first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm. Mm-hmm. Wow, you gotta take a breath when you're saying all that.
You do. You do. It's a lot. It's a lot to say and a lot to get out.
Yeah. It's a mouthful. All right. Oh goodness. So we always like to mention at the top of the show here, just our Gmail. Hit us up. Send those ravens to btkcast@gmail.com. Some of you guys have got that memorized. Some of you have heard me say it and you've memorized it, but you've yet to send in a raven. And I challenge you, all right?
Yeah.
Sir Ezra is challenging you to send us that raven, you know? Because I know people have got some ravens out there that they're thinking, you know, they've got some good thoughts and things they want to share. You know, all ravens are welcome. And I said ravens, not crows, you know? So.
Yeah, it's true. Sir Ezra, we're back again.
Yeah,
and this is our first main show recording in our new setup, and I think you know we had some hiccups the other day, but I think we you know we're improving, and as we go forward in this new way, it should be getting slightly better.
One thing I've realized is that you know, sometimes you gotta actually pull out the old Ethernet cable and run it up upstairs and actually plug it in. You know, I mean, this old Wi-Fi situation is not always the best way to operate. So, I mean, talk about getting some ancient technology out. I mean, wow, that's been a lot of fun.
But, yeah, you know, hey, just make sure that your router is set and good to go, and you've got no obstructions.
Oh, that's the funny part is, you know, my dad's like, what's going on with the Wi-Fi? I was like, well, I don't know, Dad. You've got it in a glass, you know, case here. It's enclosed underneath the stairs. I mean, it's like, you know, he's like, what? I didn't think that mattered. It's like, Dad, hold on now. Get that thing out of there. But then that still didn't help it, though, so I had to plug in and, you know, I don't know. But we're learning. We're getting it it figured out, I think. So,
yeah.
Should be good.
So, I still have somewhat of a cough, but I do feel mostly better. Hopefully I sound a little less nasally and a little better than I did last time. I was, I'm recovering from my journey on the King's Road.
Yeah. You do sound better. And I know last time we finished up and you were done.
I was like dead. Yeah. So I've got, you know, like a gallon of water next to me here. So hopefully I can, make it through.
That's good. That's awesome. I actually am kind of either coming down with something. It's like every morning I wake up, I've got a little something going on because I think it's just that back to school. Kids are all around each other. Sickness is, you know, it's the fever's getting out. What was that? What was the spring that they had where
the summer chill.
Yeah, what did they call that one summer? Remember where Baelor Breakspear dies? Baelor Breakspear and his sons, both of his sons passed away in that
In the Duncan Eggs.
Was that the spring of sickness?
Summer sickness, I think is just what they called it, yeah.
Yeah, it was some... They had a name for that spring, though, and I can't remember what it was. But anyways, or that summer. But, oh well. That's what it kind of feels like anyways. So...
Yeah. All right, well, let's go ahead and head on over to the small council. Just some kind of updates on life and some show news or some interesting show tidbits. Sir Ezra, anything exciting going on?
Not really, other than I'm thoroughly enjoying the group, like much more than I thought I would. People just, like, it's so funny the things that folks will send and tag me in there, and the conversations that are happening, they just, I don't know, man, it just makes me happy. I love going in there and seeing what's happening. So if you haven't joined yet, you're missing out. You got to get in there because it's all Game of Thrones related, and it's just cool connections. There are things about the chapter. There's discussions. We have a big discussion coming up for Follow-Up Friday based upon stuff that happened in the group. So, you know, a lot of the names you hear here on the show, a lot of our patrons are actually in there kind of leading the discussion, you know, and taking charge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
which is great.
It's our bannerman in there. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, not a whole lot going on with me. You know, things are rainy over here in my new keep.
Right.
I'll say that. Yeah, up here in the Pacific Northwest. But yeah, so far so good.
Yeah.
So
nice.
Yeah. Well, some show news, something I found kind of interesting. IGN did a top 25 best Game of Thrones episodes list. And so I'm just going to kind of pull up some of the highlights here.
Okay.
At 25, they have The Dragon and the Wolf from season 7. That is the season 7 finale. And that's kind of when we got the shows. That's like the Dragon Pit episode, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and so there's that one. Some other highlights here. Let's just skip ahead. Let's see here. 17, The Bear and the Maiden Fair. That's the that's kind of where Jaime Lannister's his redemption arc is kind of going, where he's in the fighting pit, right?
Right.
With Bran.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. 12, and now his watch has ended, season 3. This is where Marjorie kind of starts to manipulate Joffrey. Theon gets tricked into Ramsay by thinking he was escaping, and Lord Commander Mormont's watch ends. Right.
Wow.
That's kind of the big betrayal there at Craster's Keep.
Right.
And then Daenerys, that's where Daenerys gets her army, right? And she burns the slave masters. Mm-hmm. That's a huge episode.
That's a lot going on there. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Number 10, The Door. Nothing necessary there. Number 9, The Mountain and the Viper. One of the sickest fights in the show.
Oh yeah.
Let's just skip ahead here. Number 7, The Battle of the Bastards.
Okay. Yep.
Number 5, Baelor, which is season 1, episode 9, where everything, you know, goes wrong, where Ned Stark gets beheaded and everything, you know, going on there.
Yep.
Number 4 is Blackwater. That's a pretty sweet
episode. That's with Tyrion, right?
Right, with Tyrion, with the wildfire at Blackwater Bay. That's a huge episode.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Number 3, The Spoils of War, which is an episode from season 7. It's where Arya returns and has that sparring lesson with Brienne. Jon is still down at Dragonstone, and he and Daenerys are kind of, you know, going back and forth. And this is where Daenerys leads her dragons against Jaime Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a huge episode. Number 2, The Reigns of Castamere, a.k.a. The Red Wedding.
Yeah.
yeah, so, and then number 1, they say, is Hard Home, season 5. They say, the way season 5 was going, still great TV, but not the best Game of Thrones had offered. We don't think anyone expected it to deliver an episode as mighty as Hardhome. What a chilling, insane final 20 minutes. where the Night King shows up and unleashes a literal avalanche of undead minions on the last remaining frozen holdout of Mance Rayder's wildlings. It brought the White Walkers to the forefront of the series in terrifying fashion and further helped solidify Jon Snow as the show's ultimate hero, not only proving that he was right in his attempt to unite enemy factions, but that he was, as shown in season 4's The Watcher on the Wall, an action-ready badass.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, yeah, that's a good point. Can't really argue with that. I mean, he definitely does, you know. And I get, and you get that for TV. You get that, yeah,
And you get that. You get that epic stare down between Jon and the Night King, and
yeah, he definitely emerges as like the hero, right? The main character,
right?
In a sense, I mean, he was before, but it's like now, like all those things that we've been building for, you know, him. He's basically in that leadership role, and he was wanting to unite the wildlings, and yeah, it's. It finally all makes sense and starts to fit, and you see what's coming, and it's winter. You know, it's great. So,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, that fight between Jon and the White Walker is actually like pretty sweet. There's the epic part where Jon's like knocked down, and he is he's like going to grab Longclaw, and he grabs it, and he kind of stands up and fights it. And when Longclaw meets the White Walker's blade, the White Walker gives Jon this look like, what? Like,
right.
Like,
yep.
Totally. The White Walker's like totally shocked. And then Jon, you know,
yep.
does this like slash and breaks. Yeah. And kills him, which is pretty cool.
It's awesome. So awesome.
So, all right. That's well, cool. Let's go ahead and head on over to the Maester's study here. This week we're in, last week we kind of talked about the lead up to Robert's rebellion, and this is kind of so the Robert's rebellion chapter, right?
Yeah,
and,
I mean, we've been talking about the fall of the dragon, kind of,
it's all kind of one huge event.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
Really.
Yeah, it's really,
really
all of
it's
these.
Really,
combined.
It's really all of these combined. You can go all the way to kind of the tourney at Harrenhal to Robert's rebellion to like his reign is all one kind of, because it all happens really fast within the span of like a couple of years.
Right.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, here we go. Robert's rebellion. What followed Prince Rhaegar's infamous abduction of Lyanna Stark was the ruin of House Targaryen. The full depth of King Aerys' madness was subsequently revealed in his depraved actions against Lord Stark, his heir, and their supporters after they demanded for Rhaegar's wrongs. They wanted repercussions for that. Instead of granting them fair hearing, King Aerys had them brutally slain. Then following these murders by demanding that Lord Jon Arryn execute his former wards, Robert Baratheon and Eddard Stark. Many now agree that the true start of Robert's rebellion began with Lord Arryn's refusal and his courageous calling of his banners in the defense of justice. Yet not all the Lords of the Vale agreed with Lord Jon's decision, and soon fighting broke out as loyalists to the crown attempted to bring Lord Arryn down. The fighting then spread across the Seven Kingdoms like wildfire. As lords and knights took sides, many alive today fought in these battles, and so can speak with greater knowledge of them than I, who was not there. I therefore leave it to such men to write the true detailed history of Robert's Rebellion. Far be it for me to offend those who yet live by presenting an imperfect summary of events or mistakenly praising those who have since proved unworthy. So instead, I will look only to the Lord and Knight who ascended the Iron Throne at the end, repairing the realm nearly destroyed by madness. So I find this, there's a lot to take away just from this intro passage.
Oh, yeah.
And this speaks volumes about what we've been saying with World of Ice and Fire.
Yep.
Is it's all about the perspective of these maesters. I mean, so even right now they're saying, you know, many who are alive today. So as one of our listeners pointed out, was it Sir Gibbs, I want to say? This is, if you look at the beginning of this book, it looks like there's some names crossed out, right? And then you have comments. So this is being written while King Tommen is alive. So presumably where we're at in the books, I would guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and so the point, yeah, I thought this was huge as well, because it's someone doesn't want to offend, you know, the current king.
Right.
And that's basically what I got from it. It's like, I'll leave this to somebody later on who can look back at this and, you know, not have to worry about whether they're going to lose their head, you know, essentially for telling the truth here. I mean, it also right. like a lot of details about, you know, his rebellion. I feel like we're given a decent amount, like a timeline. You know, we have some mm-hmm. major events, but really we don't have a lot from the royal, you know,
right
side of things, like the crown. We don't get that mm-hmm. perspective, and so. Yeah, it's intentionally left out of here because I believe it's going to be revealed, you know, down the line. So mm-hmm. possibly in Winds of Winter, you know, in the final book. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's just interesting. Another thing, you know, this is another thing with World of Ice and Fire. It doesn't tell us the whole story. Something we've talked about here. I mean, right here. Where it just says, the full depth of King Aerys' madness was subsequently revealed in his depraved actions against Lord Stark, his heir, and their supporters. I mean, it just says, oh, he had depraved actions. It doesn't tell you what those depraved actions are. It doesn't tell you that he, like, you know, had a fire
yeah.
burning, and Brandon Stark had, like, a rope around his neck. They're on this, like, pulley system, and his dad's being hanged over fire, so he has to, like, reach out and grab this sword to try and cut his dad down, but by at the same time it's going to strangle himself. Mm-hmm. So
yep,
yeah
it's pretty ridiculous. Well, the other point here that I thought was interesting is that, like, I mean, the Mad King is mad, but he also knows that, like, I mean, really, I think the rebellion would have happened regardless of whether you know, he would have tried to execute or told Jon Arryn to execute
right.
Ned and Robert. You know, they're ticked off. I mean, so they're going to do something, you know, whether it's mm-hmm. actually call their banners and risk everybody's lives, etc. You know, it would have happened eventually, but I think by the Mad King sort of calling for their execution right away, you know, that kind of that's really what, you know, pushed us right into, as the Maester said there, that's the start of the war, is when he, you know, defies that order.
Right.
So
and, you know, something that's interesting is I would imagine young Eddard Stark would be, I mean, even without, you know, Jon Arryn has kind of raised Robert Baratheon and Eddard, you know, Eddard Stark. But I think Eddard Stark has justification of himself to just say, nope, we're done. This is over. And I mean, I think with simply the North.
Yeah.
Could he challenge the South?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, possibly.
He could. I mean, he could have led his own rebellion. It's interesting because he says he doesn't want to be king.
Yeah.
You know, but he says it's Robert's rebellion.
Yeah, what would he have done? You know, like, what? I mean, that's
really
something to think about. Before I forget, Varamyr Forskins is the one who was pointing out last week that, you know, that this whole perspective piece with, like, the start of the book and that it's written for Tommen.
Right, okay, yeah. That's who it was.
Yeah, yeah. So great connection by him. It's very important, you know, here, and this is one of the best examples we have of somebody who doesn't want to offend, you know, possible mm-hmm. current readers. So,
yeah. And then, so it's also interesting, as soon as Jon Arryn calls for Bannerman, he basically starts a mini little civil war there in the Vale.
Right.
Is what happens. And says fighting, and there's fighting breaking out, and that's kind of what's considered the first, you know, it's not the first major battle, but the loyalists are, like, wanting to overthrow Jon Arryn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yep. Absolutely.
Just, yeah.
So.
So all right. Moving on here. Good. Then it just kind of goes on here. There's not really a lot left to this kind of chapter here, but it just goes on right here. Robert Baratheon proved himself a fearless warrior, and more and more men flocked to his banner. Robert was one of the first over the walls at Gulltown when Lord Grafton raised his banner for the Targaryens, and from there he sailed to Storm's End, risking capture by the royal fleet to call his banners. Not all came willing. Aaron's hand, Lord Meriwether, encouraged certain Stormlands to rise up against Lord Robert, yet it was an effort that proved fruitless following Lord Robert's victories at Summerhall, where he won 3 battles in a single day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Robert Baratheon is a boss. We were talking about this in Fallout Friday about him fighting Rhaegar, because we're also kind of led to believe that Rhaegar is a boss. But, I mean, clearly Robert, I think, you know, in open field combat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's proven himself, too. He's engaged in a lot more. They actually mm-hmm. talk at the end of this chapter about how much more seasoned his men and Ned's men were in comparison to Rhaegar and the Dornishmen. you know, like they had mm-hmm. seen more battle and stuff. So that's a fair point for sure.
Well, and if you remember, one of the things it talked about in the Mad King and Aerys chapter was that Aerys had a lot of friends that were older, a lot of older guys, and a lot of Rhaegar's friends and companions were just a lot of younger guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have kind of these old, you know, Robert, you know, it's House Baratheon. It's not like a small house is calling
mm-hmm.
upon people. It's House Baratheon, House Stark, House Aaron. So they're going to be getting the best and the best of their,
right.
You know, of their people.
Right. Well, and you also have to remember too, you know, right before this, we have a great Raven at the end of the show today, kind of talking about this, but at Harrenhal, there, you know, the idea of a rebellion was already, or a coup of some kind is already brewing, you know, so people mm-hmm. are already kind of, this is already on people's minds, you know, so, you know, when you call your banners, they've already, some of them have already heard these grumblings and have talked about deposing the Mad King, you know, so mm-hmm. I think it makes it more likely that, you know, answer the call.
It's also interesting if you think about, I wonder if this really kind of has anything to do with it. When you think about the regions of the people that were fighting, so you have like the North, the Vale, and the Stormlands, as opposed to say like the South or like the Crownlands and like the Reach. Like, I mean, the Stormlands is a much harder area to live in than the Reach, where it's kind of these like lush fields. And I wonder, you know, if it's just kind of like when you think about the American Civil War, like the one thing we always kind of heard was like, well, the South in the American Civil War was a lot like more rural community, a lot more farmers. So a lot more, they had been around weaponry more with hunting and things like that. So they would be, we always kind of think of them as they were more skilled than perhaps like the Northern.
Yeah. Like
the Northern troops. And I wonder if is something that was kind of similar here, where you think about the North is a lot harder to live in than the South, just in all. The Vale is probably a lot harder area to live in because we know that you have the mountain men you're probably dealing with if you're, you know, in kind of like the Vale's army and things like that, as opposed to the Reach, which is like, you know, huge fields and things like that.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. The you have to kind of like you're hardened by your environment, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another thing you had just read too, the hand, Aerys' hand was working against just that proximity, being that close to King's Landing.
Right.
The Stormlands is like getting influenced by, they're kind of surrounded. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it is very crazy that Robert like sailed back there to call the banners, rally some troops, and he actually fights west to Summerhall, and then actually ends up circling back up around, you know, to mm-hmm. Ned's forces in the Riverlands,
which is an enormous push. If you really look at the map, this is where there's a really good map on the wiki that kind of shows just where all these battles took place, and they're kind of all over the place. Like, it's crazy to think about like fighting in the Stormlands. And then, like, at Summerhall, which is almost, like, down in Dorne. And it's, like, in the Reach. Like, it is, like, so far away from, like, King's Landing. And then they go all the way up to the place where he was staying. I can't remember right now. But they go all the way up there to wherever it was that he was staying, where he sleeps at. He stays at, like, the brothel for a couple of days. I'm just blanking on the name right now. And then they go all the way up to the Trident. Like, it's just kind of weird. It seems like everyone's marching their armies all over the place for this.
Like, the way I understood it was sort of like that he had to, to get his forces and to rally them. It's almost like Robert has to go into enemy territory, work his way west, and then shoot north to meet mm-hmm. up with Ned's forces as they come down. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you look at the map, they're completely kind of surrounded. The Lannisters don't really do anything, you know. But you've got Dorne, you've got Mace Tyrell. I mean, he's there. I mean, at one point, Stannis Baratheon. Remember, he is he's trapped. You know, it's so you got Davos,
right.
The Onion Knight, coming in there, rescuing everybody, bringing food in. You know, because or rats, whatever, for them to eat,
right.
Rats and onions, you know, so that they can survive. And it's just kind of crazy.
You know, I've always wondered about Stannis's take on this war, because I cannot imagine Stannis willingly going along with Robert's initial idea to rebel. But I think it's probably just because obviously he goes along with it because with Robert, who is, you know, the Lord of Storm's End, saying this is what's happening. And then Stannis is obviously just kind of drawn into it. But I just can't imagine Stannis thinking this is a good idea at the onset, because, you know, he's all about like honor. And I'm sure even still, he would probably say, well, he is still the king. That's just the kind of person Stannis is.
Yeah, it's like in his nature to want to kind of follow the law. But I think he's one of those people who kind of understands, you know, justice and honor and things. And he had to have, you know, been, you know, seeing what the Mad King was doing and know
right.
that, you know, basically his brother is going to be executed. I mean, if he doesn't
right.
do something, like, you know... So I don't know. It's yeah, you're right. You're right in that his nature would make you think.
Yeah,
initially.
But at the same time, his brother's would he really be worried about his brother being executed because he kills Renly, his other brother? So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point, actually. Interesting.
I don't
yeah.
know. It's interesting. I don't think we'll ever get any backstory on some of that. It would be really interesting, though. I think to get a lot of just to see a lot of these characters and what their thoughts were, like, what, you know, I mean, Renly would have been really young, but still, like, you know, what would be something he was thinking of? Like, I would love to get a, I really, really hope that in Winds or A Dream of Spring, if we ever get to that, that we do get maybe a POV chapter or two from somebody during the perspective, like, you know, back in time of this. So we could kind of just get more of a perspective of like what other people were thinking.
Yeah, for sure. And it's hinted here that it is going to be left to other men who are alive now to kind of tell us more about these things, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Well, you've also got, like, I love the references throughout this as to, like, in the Sansa chapter and in Robert's Rebellion here, you're getting, you get to kind of see who's on which side, you know? And then
right.
As we've read in the Game of Thrones, you have, you know, House Dairy, who had to take their Targaryen banners down, and they haven't, you know, destroyed them or burned them. They're still just put in the closet, waiting for a day when they can, you know, go back up on the walls. You know,
right.
So,
yeah, I don't know. It's super interesting, and I mean, it's something that we get in like Duncan Egg, where we get as the Sworn Sword, where we get to see somebody who fought for the Red Dragon.
Yeah.
You get to see that's like a similar take, I guess, to see about somebody from that side. So,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So,
Real quick here, is there a couple more things we wanted to point out in regards to this battle?
Did you want to go to move on to another battle, or did you want to go ahead?
Well, yeah, I was just looking here at the way. Like, it's interesting, there's a part here, I'm trying to find it, where the Kingsguard kind of splits up, right? And and it talks about that a little bit. But let's just keep going here. The Royalist forces were left reeling and scattered by such victories, though they had did their best to rally. The Kingsguard were dispatched to recover the remnants of Lord Connington's force. So Lord Connington, just before this, was actually at the Stony Sept, and you know, it was actually called the Battle of the Bells. And Connington and those guys get just pummeled, essentially.
They basically just get blown out.
Yeah. So the Kingsguard are going to find Connington's forces and try to, you know, gather them and patch them up, essentially, and get them back. Prince Rhaegar returned from the south to take command of the new levies being raised in the Crownlands. So he's kind of he's coming back from the south. Interesting, right? He's coming. Mm-hmm. From possibly Dorne, Summerhall area-ish, who knows, or Tower of Joy, I meant to say, because we know that Robert was just over, you know, at Summerhall winning three battles in one day, you know, so.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. We had talked about this. I can't remember if we talked about it on air or off air, as if Robert knew that Lyanna was at the Tower of Joy, because if you look at where Summerhall is and roughly the area that the Tower of Joy would be at, it's like like less than a day's ride is, you know, is what it looks like. I mean, Summerhall is right there. And it's interesting. If Robert knew, do you think he would have went to the Tower of Joy to get Lyanna back, or would he still keep fighting? I don't know.
I think he would have tried to, you know, free her in some way, especially if it's not super well defended. Although I think it seems like it was at the time, because, you know, Prince Lewin Martell actually brings his forces up from the south, and it is sort of like Rhaegar that kind of brings. I think he might have been down there. You know, perhaps Lyanna's doing her thing, but he's also there trying to, you know, make sure that he has Dorne's support. You know,
right?
Perhaps maybe he was trying to. Yeah, because again, remember, he's before all of this. He's before war is declared. He's, you know, kind of scheming, and he's at the tourney of Harrenhal trying to get people together. Maybe he did steal Lyanna, head south to talk to Dorne about something. Although it seems kind of like a crazy place for him to go with the girl who he just insulted his wife with. But we just don't know what his plans were. What he was gonna, you know?
No.
So. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and then right here, from Dorne in defense of Princess Elia, 10,000 spears came over the Boneway and marched to King's Landing to bolster the host that Rhaegar was raising. So, I mean, that's a lot of people, you know, 10,000 people coming up there. There were those who were at court during the final time have recounted that Aerys' behavior was erratic. He was untrusting of even his Kingsguard, and then only imperfectly, for he kept Sir Jaime Lannister close at all hours to serve as a hostage against his father. Which is, you know, that's interesting, is that he's thinking of Jaime as his Kingsguard, as his hostage.
So. Right. Yeah. The only ones he really trusted, I mean, were as well. Basically, he only trusted his Kingsguard, and then I don't think he'd really trusted Jaime, but
I don't think he did either.
No, but Sir Barristan Selmy for sure, right? I mean, he's the one who rescued him and got the title of Sir Barristan the Bold, you know. So, right. But yeah, he's definitely losing his mind.
So then it says, when Prince Rhaegar at last marched up the King's Road to the Trident, with him were all but one of the King's Guard who had remained in King's Landing, Sir Barristan the Bold, Sir Jonathor Derry, and Prince Lewin of Dorne. Prince Lewin took the command of the Dornish troops sent by his nephew, the Prince Doran. But it is said that he did so only after the threats of the Mad King, who feared that the Dornish men looked to betray him. Only young Sir Jaime Lannister remained in King's Landing.
Now that's interesting. So that just said that when Prince Rhaegar at last marched up the King's Road to the Trident, with him were all but one of the Kingsguard. So...
were all but one of the Kingsguard who had remained in King's Landing.
Okay, there you go. Thank you. All right, there we go.
Yeah. So Arthur Dayne and the other guys aren't there.
I was going to say, that didn't make any sense at all at first. Okay. Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
But good. I don't believe it mentions, actually, in the chapter, who these other guys are. I mean, we know, but...
Yeah, no, I don't think it said anything about how the Kingsguard... It just says that they were, at one point, sent to kind of... to get Connington's forces... You know, right. And to help recover them, but that was about it, as far as, you know, yeah. So it doesn't really mention him.
Yeah.
Goes on to talk about Sir Barristan and, you know, and what happened with him at the Battle of the Trident. Because next up is the famous battle on the Trident. Much has been written and said, but all know that the two armies clashed at the crossing, that would ever after be called the Ruby Ford. For the scattered rubies on Prince Rhaegar's armor. The opponents were well matched. Rhaegar's forces numbered 40,000, and a tenth of that number were knights, you know?
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? So that's like somewhat, you know, 4,000, you know, knights or something there with him. Some seasoned, right. You know, folks. But then they say Robert and, you know, Eddard had just under that, but more seasoned, harder, you know, more experienced, or, you know, had been in more battles, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
Yeah. And then it doesn't really talk a lot about the battle at the Trident, because again, it goes off to kind of say, you know, there's been so much written about it. It's just which is interesting. It says the battle screamed about Lord Robert and Prince Rhaegar both, and by the will of the gods, or by chance, or by perhaps design, they met amidst the shallows of the ford. The two knights fought valiantly upon their destriers, according to all accounts. For despite his crimes, Prince Rhaegar was no coward. Lord Robert was wounded by the dragon prince in combat, yet in the end, Baratheon's ferocious strength and his thirst to avenge the shame brought upon his stolen betrothed proved the greater. His warhammer found its mark, and Robert drove the spike through Rhaegar's chest, scattering the costly rubies that blazed upon the prince's breastplate.
Yeah, so a couple interesting things here. Just that the way in which they met on the battlefield, it was either by the will of the gods, by chance, or perhaps by design. And it's like it's separated by some dashes, and it's really emphasized in the text. And even when I was listening to it today, I mean, like the reader of the audiobook was like really pausing for dramatic effect on that line. So yeah, I mean, how is it that they came to, you know, those two great warriors came to fight one another? You know, it's just kind of interesting, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the thing
about the rubies scattering, the rubies that blazed upon the prince's breastplate. So when it says they blazed, does that just mean that they were there, or does that mean that they literally were blazing?
Right. Well, yeah. And so the next paragraph is interesting too. Some men on both sides stopped fighting at once, leaping instead into the river to recover the precious stones. So that makes me think, you know, was it just poor men who wanted to make a fortune, or was there something significant about those particular stones?
Right.
You know, and it says men
is interesting about that, in the idea of it being a glamour, because as far as we know, to glamour, all you need is one stone, right? So, I mean, why would there need to be, like, you know, it makes it sound like there's hundreds of these, you know, little rubies in his chest or something.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. It could be something, I mean, as simple as, like, they wanted there to be more to disguise the fact that it is a disguise, you know. That's the only thing I can think of to really, you know, maybe it's sort of like, that's, you know, it would look weird to have I don't know, more suspicious or something. I don't know.
Maybe is it some sort of like projection, like they do in The Last Jedi?
Yeah, he's force projected there for sure. Yeah,
except he's actually there, you know, like fighting. So it's not just like a person pretending to be Rhaegar. It is like Rhaegar through a glamour, right? Like some sort of magic, like projecting himself somewhere. I don't know.
Well, and you know, I don't know that they ever in the series talk about what Rhaegar said. If he said, like, Robert doesn't really recall that he said anything to him, you know, or anything. And you would think there would have been some words or some exchange between the two. And
right,
there's really not. So,
yeah. Yeah,
but I
don't know.
But Lord Robert is wounded, though, by
yes,
whoever this person is. If this is Rhaegar,
yeah.
And it's sort of like he cannot take up the pursuit, because basically once Rhaegar falls, his forces start to kind of crumble and flee. They break apart, and yeah, it almost seems like, you know, the battle was raging, and they got to this point where people like saw them, you know, fighting, and you could almost imagine both sides were kind of like, this is, you know, the battle's going to be decided by the winner of, you know, this melee. So
right, yeah. And then so Robert is not able to give pursuit, and really the only thing left in this little chapter here is that he does not kill Barriss and Selmy. He proves his chivalry when he refused to allow the grievously wounded Ser Barristan to be killed. Instead, he sent his own Maester to tend to the great knight. In such fashion did the future king win the fierce devotion of his friends and allies, for few men were ever so open-handed and merciful as Robert Baratheon. So, yeah, and so then we have the end here, which is just the last little bit of the dragons. Birds flew and couriers raced to bear word of the victory at the Ruby Ford. When the news reached the Red Keep, it is said that Aerys cursed the Dornish, certain that Luwin had betrayed Rhaegar. He sent his pregnant queen, Rhaella, and his younger son and new heir, Viserys, away to Dragonstone. But Princess Elia was forced to remain in King's Landing with Rhaegar's children as a hostage against Dorne. Having burned his previous hand, Lord Chelsted, alive for bad counsel during the war, Aerys now appointed another to the position, the alchemist Rosart, a man of low birth with little to recommend him but his flames and trickery. Sir Jaime Lannister was meanwhile left in charge of the Red Keep's defenses. The walls were manned by knights and watchmen awaiting the enemy. When the first army that arrived flew the Lion of Casterly Rock with Lord Tywin at its head, King Aerys anxiously ordered the gates to be opened, thinking that at last his old friend and former hand had come to his rescue, as he had done at the defiance of Duskendale. But Lord Tywin had not come to save the Mad King.
Doesn't that kind of just blow your mind? Like, because if only he knew. I mean, Tywin, when he comes to Duskendale, he's also we're not sure what he was going to do. You know,
right?
I think he was okay with possibly just, I mean, go ahead and kill the king. You know, we have Rhaegar's outside of Duskendale, and so it's just kind of mind blowing that he didn't have very good counsel or very good awareness. And he had really soiled that relationship with Tywin. And how does he think that? He's just so foolish there. I don't know. It's just crazy. And he goes against the counsel of Varys, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know later that Varys counseled him to keep his gates closed.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's interesting. But then basically it just goes on to say the Red Keep was soon breached, but in the chaos, misfortune soon fell upon Elia of Dorne and her children, Rhaenys and Aegon. It is tragic that their blood spilled in war. Many may as readily be innocent as it is guilty, and that those who ravished and murdered Princess Elia escaped justice. It is not known who murdered Princess Rhaenys in her bed or smashed the infant Prince Aegon's head against a wall. Some whisper it was done at Aerys' own command when he learned that Lord Lannister had taken up Robert's cause, while others suggest that Elia did it herself out of fear as what would happen to her children in the hand of her dead husband's enemies. Aerys' hand, Rosart, was killed at a postern gate after cravenly attempting to flee the castle. And last of all to die was King Aerys himself, at the hand of his remaining Kingsguard knight, Sir Jaime Lannister. Like his father, Sir Jaime did as he thought best for the realm, bringing an end to the Mad King. And so ended both the reign of House Targaryen and Robert's rebellion. The war that put an end to nearly 300 years of Targaryen rule and ushered in a new golden era under under House Baratheon. So
yeah.
So here's a question for you, Sir Ezra. Let's say that Jaime didn't kill the Mad King, and the Mad King is not successfully able to blow up the city, right, or burn anyone. What would Tywin Lannister do? I mean, this is a total what if, but still, you know.
Yeah, what would he have done with the Mad King?
Yeah.
I think he might have made him to stand trial and executed him.
And then do they place Rhaegar? Well, Rhaegar is dead at this point, so I guess never mind.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, you still, though, have, well, let's see, you still have Viserys, you know?
Right.
You still have Viserys. You still have Rhaella over on Dragonstone. Mm-hmm. So what would they have done with them, you know?
Yeah.
Would they have held another? See, the problem is that the Targaryens have... And Aegon, the unlikely, knew this was going to happen. Well, I think, well, take that back. He was trying to rebuild sort of the Targaryen family, dynasty, etc.
Right.
And, you know, the tragedy of Summerhall happens. But because their numbers dwindled after the Dance of Dragons big time, and then they continue.
And then they get back up, and then it's just when you get to Aegon the Unlikely, so many crazy events happen.
Yeah. Yep.
That, yeah, you get down to, like, nobody.
Right, because I don't really know, I don't really feel like who are their supporters anymore, you know? Like who are their,
right?
Like, who are the Targaryens? They're such a small, you know, group anymore that, yeah, we were moving towards a time where Targaryens wouldn't rule anymore. There are no dragons, you know, the dragon riders, it's not a thing right now. So, Tywin might have actually said, yeah, let's hold a great council and let's pick a new king, you know. I think they would have kept the format of the Seven Kingdoms, you know, being united under King, you know, there at King's Landing. I think they would have. I know that seems kind of crazy because it's been Targaryens and, you know, and all of that. They could have picked a Targaryen. Maybe a Viserys name is put forward, you know, Robert's name is put forward. Tywin might put his own name forward. You know, I don't know. Because I guess, you know, you have other people who were, you've said before, Robert, you know, has somewhat of a claim because he does have that Targaryen connection, you know? So they might, they might have tried to piece it together and looked at distant family, you know, who were either, you know, somewhat related or removed slightly in one way or another. So like House Valerion, you know, like there's a house that you could have, you know, possibly hit up and found a Targaryen to kind of sit on the throne. But maybe, I mean, at this point they're done with them. I mean, they've shown that they're, you know, lusty and power hungry and mad and crazed, and their ways kind of go against the Seven, you know, and even the, well, I don't know about the old gods, but yeah, they get in a lot of different disputes with Old Town. So yeah, I think he might've just said, you know, done with the Targaryens. So
it's possible. Yeah. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's all interesting to think about. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, we will have.
I don't know. I have no idea what Robert would have done. Robert, I don't know. Robert doesn't seem like the kind of person who would have people executed, though.
Yeah, I know that was. I thought that was a really good point. In that he's very merciful. And that was something people really liked about him. You know, is that he's not looking to just. You know, he's not. If he's going to kill somebody, he wants to kill him for the right reason. If he's going to go to war, it's for a good cause, you know, type of thing. So he does have that going for him, even though he's lusty in other ways, you know, and stuff.
But. Well, and later it seems he is more willing to execute people, right? Because he wants Daenerys killed, but then he kind of thinks about it, right? And he's like, no, it was a dumb. Yeah, you're right, Ned. It was a dumb idea. So I don't know. So anyway, let us know your thoughts.
Yeah, and that's a very short Robert's Rebellion, because there are a guy we've recommended before. I think it's Atlas of Ice and Fire. You've got,
oh my God, it's so good.
So such a good, you know, breakdown explanation of the battles and where they took place and how the armies, you know, moved. Really gives you a good visual for that battle and helps you kind of understand how, well, really just what a great accomplishment it was for Robert to get his men out and back up to, you know, River Run to unite and press down on King's Landing. So,
yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so we'll keep talking about it. And there's more, you know, we can go over the different, like, I think it's kind of cool to cover the minor houses at some point. Maybe we'll do this on our Patreon series and talk about those minor houses, that side, which side were they on, you know, and who was fighting. Because you've got 40,000 versus another 40,000 on that battlefield made up of various houses and stuff. So really interesting.
Yeah. So.
All right.
All right. Well, it's time to move on to the reread. This last week we were in Catelyn 5. Catelyn and Sir Roderick had taken shelter from the rain at the inn at the crossroads. Soon after, Tyrion Lannister and his party arrive. Tyrion recognizes Catelyn, who had hoped to remain anonymous, and Catelyn takes this opportunity to convince the men in the room to take Tyrion captive so that he can face the king's justice in Winterfell. So, this week we're in Sansa 2, but the last time we were in a Sansa chapter. So this is kind of the problem with a POV read, is that the last time we were in Sansa 1. And after exploring the camp, Sansa Stark had gone riding with her betrothed, Prince Joffrey. Near the Ruby Ford, they had come across Arya Stark and a butcher's boy play fighting. Joffrey begins to torment the boy until Arya attacks him. So that seems like a long time ago, and we've seen stuff with Sansa, but that's because she's in, you know, she is in Arya chapters and Eddard chapters. So sometimes that is the problem with the POV reads, is that you see this a lot with characters that have crossover paths. Like in Clash of Kings, it's a lot of Tyrion and Sansa chapters, you know, go back and forth. And Cersei doesn't have chapters in that book, but they're in a lot of chapters together. And then in like a lot of the Jon and Sam chapters, you know, there's a lot of crossover. So, Yeah. So this week we're in Sansa 2. Sansa is enthralled by the tourney, especially the knights. Sir Gregor Clegane kills a new made knight named Sir Hugh in a joust. And after a victory, Sir Loras Tyrell gives her a rose. During the feast that follows, Prince Joffrey is very courteous, but afterwards he orders the Hound to escort Sansa back to her chambers. When the Hound notices Sansa is avoiding looking at his burned face, he forces her to look and tells her how he acquired it. So I have this kind of broken into three parts here. We have the first part, which is the tourney, the second part, which is the feast, and the third part, which is, did I ever tell you how I got these scars?
Yeah, that's great. That's freaking great.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so yeah, I found this chapter interesting. Basically because it's another one of those things where you get some of these smaller houses, various knights, you get more of their house coat of arms, sigils, and what have you. So that to me was one of the coolest things that came out of this chapter. I'm kind of like Sansa. I'm you know, as they're rolling into this tourney, I'm like entranced. I'm like, who's next? Who is this guy? Who is that guy? Where are they from? So that's kind of how I was reading this chapter.
Yeah, let me pull it up here. Sorry, I have like a million things open. Sometimes you know, somebody posted something the other day in the group where they're talking about like how Sir Matt and Sir Ezra must prepare for these. And it's just like Stephen Colbert's just like ripping through all these pages. And it is literally, I have two computer screens up and my phone, and like, we got a book next to me. And
yeah. Oh yeah.
So just the first paragraph here. Sansa rode to the Hand's tourney with Septa Mordain and Jane Poole in a litter with curtains of yellow silk so fine she could see right through them. They turned the whole world gold. Beyond the city walls, 100 pavilions had been raised beside the river, and the common folk came out in the thousands to watch the games. The splendor of it all took Sansa's breath away. The shining armor, the great chargers caparisoned in silver and gold, the shouts of the crowd, the banners snapping in the wind, and the knights themselves, the knights most of all. It is better than the songs, she whispered.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's ready to go. It's a great day for a, you know, for a tourney. Interesting that I didn't notice in this that that the Hand, that Ned was actually there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like is he there at this tourney?
Mm-hmm. He would have to be. I mean, it's his tourney. I think in the show we see him, don't
yeah,
we?
In the show we do. They don't really mention it here. Like, what I noticed was interesting is at the end of this and going into the next chapter, it seems like him and Barristan Selmy come from somewhere. And it didn't seem like he was actually even at his own tourney. But that could be totally wrong with that. It just seemed that way when I was reading this chapter. I was like, where the heck is he?
It's when Sir Hugh dies is when they, I think, yeah. Well, in the show, see, this might be another thing. In the show, right, we see him with Robert, convincing Robert to not put on armor and fight in the tourney. Right.
Yeah, and so I take that back. He is actually at the tourney, but I just mean like this day one here with Sansa. It doesn't seem It doesn't seem like he's sitting there with her. But
no. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because he does come in. He does come in the next day. Like he's walking through, looking at the tents, and he's trying to find Robert later on. So.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see here. Let's get into some of these knights. So it mentions that the seven knights of the Kingsguard, they were definitely there and involved, all but Jaime Lannister, because, he was there, but he's in different type of armor. He's in the scaled armor, the color of milk, but he had his white cloak, but beneath that he had this shining gold, head to foot like armor, with a lion's helm and a golden, sword. So he's a little, flashy, and he's out there ready to go. But they're all in this tourney, which I think is kind of neat because a lot of them get kind of beat. I don't think any of them make it to the final four except for...
No.
Does Jamie make it to the final four? Who is the final four of this?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. It'll show me here in a second. I know Loras Tyrell is there. The Hound,
right.
The Mountain, but I can't remember the
other person.
Yeah, the fourth person. Was it Jaime? might have been. We'll find out here at the end. It lists the four at the end of the chapter.
Yeah, it is interesting. They're talking about all these people in their armor. I found this one interesting. Lord Jon Royce, who had guested at Winterfell 2 years before. His armor is bronze, thousands and thousands of years old, engraved with magic runes that ward him against harm.
Dude, I'm telling you right now, I had the same thing underlined. you know, same thing I wanted to talk about. Because I think his two sons also have, it's not the ancient armor, but they have runes or magical something. It mentions, like, you know, on in their armor as well, I think.
Right.
So it'll talk about his sons in a sec. But yeah, so what's up with that? You know, is it, going back to Rhaegar, is it like, maybe it's not a glamour, it's supposed to be extra, you know, protection or something.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's just interesting. It's all just interesting. Here we go. Here we hear another, these magic, you know. Now, it could just be that Sansa is talking about this armor and, you know, because it's from Sansa's perspective, right? And then we have Jason Malister.
Who we met last week, didn't we? When he was with Catelyn, isn't he the one who was coming south and he didn't recognize her?
It says he had cut down three of Rhaegar's bannermen at the Trident. The girls giggled over the warrior priest Thoris of Myr with his flapping red robes and shaven head until the Septa told him that he once scaled the walls of Pyke with a flaming sword in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just says a bunch of hedge knights from the Fingers and Highgarden and the Mountains of Dorne. You know, there's tons of knights, it seems like, and you know, sons of lords from all over the realm coming to this tournament.
Yeah, yeah, they point out a couple. So Sir Balin Swan, Lord Bryce Caron, the Marches, Bronze,
Andar Royce and Robar Royce.
Yep. So Jon's heirs there.
Was it Horace and Haber who are the red wines, the grape? They have the grape cluster sigil of House Redwine.
Yep. Yep, and then some younger Malisters are there. Lord Jason Malister's sons, six Freys, all listed there as well. We don't really. Who cares about the Freys? You know.
Really, I mean, do they ever do anything?
Watch of use. It's bittersweet. They're gonna sit on the throne at the end.
Oh my God, that'd be ridiculous.
That'd be ridiculous. Yeah, let's see a couple other ones here. Well, no, that's basically it that they list. Bastard son. Oh, his bastard son. Yeah, so a bunch of Freys are there. So, and then you get some neat. Jane Poole starts to kind of point out a couple knights that she's super interested in, and I can't say this guy's name, but it's he's the exile prince from the Summer Islands. He wore like a cape of green and scarlet feathers.
Jalabar Zo.
Yeah,
is his name, I think. Yeah.
Yep. And then she notices our good friend, the young Lord Beric Dondarrion. With his hair like red gold and his black shield slashed by lightning, she pronounced herself willing to marry him on the instant. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hound, so. And then the Hound is entered, and Renly, and just a bunch of people.
Yeah. Just really kind of neat to see everybody coming together. They go on and talk about the jousting for a bit, and you know, basically if you want to see this broken down, if you go to the A World of Ice and Fire, the wiki, Westeros.org, there, you can look at the different jousts, and you can see, you know, Jorah Cassel defeating one of the Red Wines. It's interesting about this, you know, Jorah, the way he was dressed, remember that part, and how he just kind of looked like a, I think it was even Septa Mordain said that he looked like a beggar among these other, riders, so other knights.
Right.
So. But yeah, so it kind of goes through and it lists all of them, you know, and who beat who, type of thing. Jaime Lannister, you know, beating one of the Royces, and then that Bryce Caron, you know. So yeah, Barristan Selmy's defeating other people. So yeah,
right. Right here, the most terrifying moment of the day came during Sir Gregor's second joust, when his lance rode up and struck a young knight from the Vale under the gorget with such force that it drove through his throat, killing him instantly. Yeah, that's Sir Hugh of the Vale.
Right, they make it seem like it's just no one of great importance, because he's going to be the
right.
you know, who they're looking at next chapter, really. So yeah, there's just little tease there. If you, you know,
yeah, and then they talk about how each of them handled it, and you know, Jane Poole is weeping hysterically, and Septa Mordain, and Sansa says is kind of watching with a weird fascination by it.
Yeah, she's struck that she doesn't actually, like, you know, cry really, and that this is kind of the first person she's ever seen die.
Right.
And she believes that she would have cried if it was like Jory or her father or you know, but she. It says that she spent all of her tears on Lady, you know? So she thinks that's one of the reasons possibly why she's not, like, weeping hysterically, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of like Jane. But yeah.
So then it talks about Gregor Clegane and just people who's beating who. Balin Swan is beaten by the Mountain. Renly is beaten by the Hound. And I do find it that, like, Renly gets knocked off and, like, all the ladies in the court are... You know, like,
yeah,
so nervous and worried.
Right.
But then I found this one most interesting, which just kind of goes back to the point I've been saying. So anyway, back to Beric Dondarrion not being that good. Later, a hedge knight in a checkered cloak disgraced himself by killing Beric Dondarrion's horse and was declared forfeit. Later, Beric shifted his saddle to a new mount, only to be knocked right off it by Thoros of Myr.
Yeah. And I would go to his defense there and say he had a new mount, and it might have been a faulty mount.
It's true.
So there's that.
Hey, maybe.
But I think that's where their friendship develops. Actually, I think
right. I think it is too.
I think these two become friends right after that and get to know each other. So,
well, and Thoros of Myr is also like no slouch.
Oh my gosh,
he's really good.
He's legendary. I mean, he's known.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his appearance, I mean, that's the thing. It says at the beginning that the girls were laughing at his appearance, but then once they're told, you know, basically how brave he is and how, you know, all of his feats and stuff, they're kind of like, okay, well, this guy's, you know, pretty legit. So, yeah, and then it just goes over a bunch of the tilts, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just goes over a bunch of the tilts, and I think it's right here. It says, this is where it kind of starts to bring up Loras Tyrell. After each victory, Sir Loras would remove his helm and ride slowly around the fence and finally pluck a single white rose from the blanket and toss it to some fair maiden in the crowd. And then his last match of the day was against the younger Royce. Sir Robar's ancestral runes proved small protection as Sir Loras split his shield and drove him from his saddle to crash with an awful clangor in the dirt. Robar lay moaning, as the victor made his circuit of the field, finally they called for a litter and carried him off to his tent. Dazed and unmoving, Sansa never saw it, her eyes only for Sir Loras. When the white horse stopped in front of her, she thought her heart would burst. To the other maidens, he had given white roses, but the one he plucked for her was red. "Sweet lady," he said, "no victory is half so beautiful as you."
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where she falls madly in love. You know, she's done. So she's got her Joffrey, but this is a gallant knight. You know, he's only 16. Mm-hmm. He's only 16 years old, actually. The youngest son of Mace Tyrell. So pretty cool. So then she, Sansa says, that she sees the Hound, doesn't she? Oh, no. He had gray-green eyes that did not smile when his mouth did. You have the look of a Tully. So this is where Littlefinger shows up and actually kind of stops in there for a second. Oh, boy. He's obsessed, you know, with... he has this moment where, like, touches her cheek and, like, brushes her hair. And he leaves, like, abruptly. Almost like he's, like, disturbed, you know, or he's shook in some way because of the, you know, just the how striking she was or how much she resembled her mother, you know. So there's Peter Baelish showing up being a weirdo and a creep. So there's that. In the mention of the – never forget he has the silver mockingbird. You know, that's what his sort of sigil
right.
Is moving forward. Now, the Septa Mordain basically, you know, filled it. She kind of fills Sansa in as to who this is, you know. And then once he leaves, Joffrey, does Joffrey show up? Yeah, but later Sansa.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's talking about how, basically how the Hound is going to, you know, kind of could handle, handle all these guys. And then when, once he's old enough, you know, then, then he could enter into the list and it's going to be no problem. So he's his normal braggadocious self.
Right.
Yeah. So, but here's the point you had mentioned before with the problem with it being such a long time between the point of views is that Joffrey is acting very different towards Sansa here.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
totally different. Yeah,
totally different.
Right, because of you know he's still kind of viewing her at fault as to what happened, you know, with Arya.
Yeah, yeah. So, and this is actually. This is where I think they take off. I might have missed it. This is where they head to the feast afterwards, right? Because that was right. Sir Loras's last kind of tilt there. And, you know, the only four contestants that are remaining are Sir Gregar, the Hound, Sir Jaime Lannister, Sir Loras Tyrell. So wait a second. I'm missing one. Who's the other one? Sir Gregor.
Yeah, who is
Sir Jaime?
Who is the fourth?
And Sir Loras. I mean, it's like they don't. I'm trying to figure out who
the Hound.
Oh, the Hound. I'm reading them as the same. Right. I was.
You're viewing them as yep.
So you've got So you've got Gregor and Sandor, Jaime, and then Sir Loras. Yeah, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Got those mixed up. So those are the four that are left over, and then then they're heading in for their feast, and this is where Joffrey's and he's feeding her. He's giving her wine. He's feeding her food.
He's giving up.
You know, I mean, why do you think he's acting so differently now?
At the same time, it is kind of interesting that he, like, I don't really know why he, I mean, it's just because he's Joffrey, I guess, would kind of blame Sansa for this. This is actually a scene where I think the show kind of does a really good job of, because even at this point, I still feel like the books haven't opened up enough yet. Like, I really don't feel like the books really kind of change your perspective on people until about Storm of Swords when you get that first Jaime chapter. I would still argue at this point it's like a Stark books, right? I mean, you have the Tyrion chapters and the Daenerys one, but Daenerys feels so far away, and Tyrion is just slightly different. But the rest are all Stark people, so you still kind of feel on the side of the Starks. In the show, we get that scene with Joffrey and Cersei where Cersei is like taping him up and Joffrey has that line with her where he says, so everyone that's not us is our enemy, right? Or she says it. And I think that is like a good scene in the show to kind of say like, this is why he would start to kind of hate, Sansa, because he says, I don't want to marry her. Because before he seems like he's okay with the idea of it. And then it's just it must just only be from that one incident.
Yeah, good point. I was thinking actually that it might have been that scene in the show is sort of like, you know, I think she says he can screw whoever he wants, he can do whatever he wants, you know, but like basically keeping it's important to keep the Starks or your enemies, you know, closer. And so that if that conversation happened right before the Hand's tourney, then that would answer the question as to why he's sitting next to her, you know, right. You know, feeding her food, having her drink some wine, keeping her close, you know, keeping up appearances and things.
Right.
You know, for sure. So like he helps her eat like a snail, which I thought was funny. I just thought back to the snail. Now every time ever since we've read The Hedge Knight, anytime I see anything that references those books, I just think it's, you know, pulls my attention a little bit. But yeah, so he's helping her eat some different types of food and things, and she notices actually when he goes to feed her that snail or a couple of different things that his arm is still bothering him.
Right.
From where Nymeria had, you know, jumped on him and bit him and things. But
Yeah. And then there's one kind of interesting thing here that's kind of like hidden in this when they're all, because it's mostly just about the different foods they're eating and stuff. And that's they kind of hear a commotion and it's, you know, a drunk Robert Baratheon kind of yelling at his wife, Cersei. Now everybody heard him. No, he thundered in a voice that drowned out all the other speech. Sansa was shocked to see the king off his feet, red of face, reeling. He had a goblet of wine in one hand, and he was drunk as a man could be. "You do not tell me what to do, woman," he screamed at Cersei. "I am the king here. Do you understand? I rule here, and if I say that I will fight tomorrow, I will fight." And it's just, you know, it's just, it's Robert. This is, you know, this is where you kind of get to see some of the bad side of Robert. You know, he's hammered, and he's yelling at her for a reason that's totally stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I thought this was interesting for a different reason, because I actually think Cersei was trying to convince him to fight. Like, it's this reverse psychology, because...
I think you're right.
Remember, yeah. Later on, they say that they had plans. I think it's Varys or somebody had mentioned that they had plans to kill the king, you know, at the Hand's Tourney.
They have him in the melee.
They wanted him to get in there, and then they had a plan to kind of... Hopefully it would go wrong, or he'd be too drunk or something, you know, and they would actually have him killed. So I thought, I was like, wow, you know, she's probably, she just knows how to manipulate him, you know, and so
right.
She's.
Well, I mean, especially, I mean, just this next line right here, everyone was staring. Sansa saw Ser Barristan and the king's brother Renly and the short man who had talked to her so oddly and touched her hair, but no one made a move to interfere. The queen's face was a mask, so bloodless that it might have been sculpted from snow. She rose from the table, gathered her skirt around her, and stormed off in silence, servants trailing behind. Mm-hmm. I just like that the queen's face was a mask. Like, clearly, yep. You know, she is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's definitely it. So that's one of those little things where other parts of the series and things, when we look back at this, we can say, wow, right there she was... You know, he's clearly drunk and having a good time, and he might have said something about, you know, him participating, or he could have done this or that better, you know, and she just is going to mock him and kind of force him into, you know, maybe they were having a conversation before this, and all we get is the, no, you're not going to tell me what to do, woman, I'm king here, you know, and so on, right. So, and that he will fight tomorrow, but
yeah. And then basically it goes on from there, and they're talking about it's growing late, and he says, you know, it grows late, the prince said. He had a queer look on his face as if he were not seeing her at all. Do you need an escort back to the castle? No, Sansa began. She looked for Septa Mordain. I mean to say, yes, thank you. That would be most kind. I am tired. And then I'm assuming she's thinking, oh, Joffrey will walk me back. And he yells out, dog. And then Sandor Clegane comes out.
Yeah. Yep. Well, she's a little shocked there. What's her face is almost passed out, isn't she? Her Septa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's passed out drunk. So the Hound takes her back, and he kind of mocks her, makes fun of her, and, mm-hmm. you know, and says, like, you know,
yep.
You kind of thought that, you know, Joffrey was going to walk you back, didn't you? You know, and makes fun of the idea that, you know, she's just this little bird. Right, this pretty little bird that keeps reciting nice words or words she's been taught, and he's trying to, in a weird way, he's trying to educate her.
Right, he is, yeah. And so he kind of is mocking her about, like, I think he calls her sir. She says, "You rode gallantly today, Sir Sandor," and he freaks out and he's like, "I'm not a sir." And then she's talking about, "Did you see my brother?" He says he was, and the Hound says gallant, and then he kind of mocks her some more. And they just kind of go on about that for a little bit, and then it's when they're walking in is when he starts to kind of tell her about, like, how he got his scars or how his face got burned.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and he tells the story, unless you want to read it. Did you want to read it?
Oh, no, I mean, I think everyone pretty much knows it. Just, you know, he was playing with a toy of his brother, and then his brother got mad and shoved his face in the fire. It's, you know, totally what happened.
What I think is crazy is that his father covers it up, you know? And then there's that later on, we find out about, like, a mysterious death, the mysterious deaths that happened around House Clegane. And I just think it's crazy that the father would cover up that type of, but I mean, these are his sons and he wants them, you know, he wants his house to be renown and to grow and to be more prosperous. So, you know, he's going to look over some monstrous episode here between his sons, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
So, and then I think at the end, so she feels kind of sad for the Hound, you know, she's actually not, like, really afraid of him anymore. She's really just more, like, sad. And that kind of, I think, pisses him off. And so he basically says that she makes her swear to never tell anybody, you know, that she that right. Yeah, that he told this story. Otherwise, he says, the hound caught her by the arm and leaned close. "The things I told you tonight," he said, his voice sounding even rougher than usual. "If you ever tell Joffrey, your sister, your father, any of them." "I won't," Sansa whispered. "I promise." It was not enough. "If you ever tell anyone," he finished, "I'll kill you."
Yep.
So, I mean, Woody, though, Sir Matt.
I don't know.
Woody. I think he knows how to scare a little girl.
I think he does too.
I think he knows how to scare her. I think he knows that she's a little bird, and he wants to. He can tell she's afraid, and so he's going to use that to his advantage. It would cause a war. He knows he wouldn't do that, but
right.
But he knows it's what he needs to say right now. So, yeah. Oh goodness.
Okay.
So that is the chapter this week. You know, kind of interesting how we go from the tourney to the feast and then the walk home. But it's got some good stuff in there. A lot of more character building, more world building. You get more of those houses and things, which I think is really neat. So on to Cinda Raven here. And we actually have one from Sir Robert of Newcastle. And I'm pretty sure I haven't read this. And if I'm wrong, then I apologize. But it kind of fits in with our discussion today. So he says, "Hey, guys, Sir Robert of Newcastle here. I was listening to the podcast on Monday, and it got me wondering what would have happened if Rhaegar had performed a coup of his father or on his father. Would the war still have happened? Who would have won? I still think the war would have happened, but with a different outcome. Yes, I still believe Robert would have risen, but with very different sparks. Rhaegar and Lyanna would have got together, and the jealous slash perpetuance and envy of Robert would have raised his banners, basically because of that jealousy right. And their relationship. But whether it was for love or for a hostage, the North could not join the war. So, with Ned out of the fight or even possibly opposed to Baratheon's army, they would have been destroyed. If Rhaegar was king, at this point his full Kingsguard would be around him. Young Jaime, Sir Arthur Dayne, Barristan the Bold. I don't think that that might, when it's unified, could have been defeated. Yeah, so happy to discuss my theory. I thought that was interesting. It's sort of a what-if sort of a scenario. You know, if...
right.
What do you think, Sir Matt?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, it's interesting because we still don't really know the Lyanna aspect of it, right? Like, did he take her just to take her? Did he take her for some crazy, you know, prophecy involving like the, you know, the others and Winter and all of that? And if the marriage was annulled, you know, I mean, if going off the show here, just kind of because that's where we have some theoretical information. Let's say the marriage was annulled, right, between him and Elia Martell, and he does marry Lyanna Stark. I don't know that the Starks would have, like, so let's say Brandon and Rickard Stark don't die, right? Because they don't ride down because everyone just knows that he married her. And so then he's kind of doing his own civil war. I think that's like an interesting way to do it. I think that Robert Baratheon would just be out of luck. I don't think there'd be anything he could do. I think he would just be out of luck. And so then maybe he would fight with the with the Mad King on that side. But then you'd have like Eddard Stark, and I feel like the Starks would have to back Rhaegar. So, you know, that's an enormous force. So I don't know. I think kind of Robert Baratheon would kind of have to sit it out, and, you know, maybe the Lannisters would fight with the Mad King. And maybe he would say, well, maybe I'll marry Cersei to Viserys later. I would kind of say that the Mad King would end up kind of losing just because you'd have the power of the North and, you know, you'd be screwed. Because the North, I mean, like, and I don't know. I don't see a lot of people being interested in fighting. Maybe Dorne fights alongside the Mad King, but I don't know.
So, my two cents on the on Sir Robert's what-if scenario here. Basically, it comes down to whether or not the Starks can communicate with Lyanna. You know, if they can, then I think she's able to either tell them, you know, that she's okay. She wanted to do this. She wanted to go about this willingly. They make it seem like in the book series, though, that she's captured and she's taken, though, which is tough. So, you know, and the other whole part is, you know, if Lord, Stark is actually executed, you know, if Brandon is executed as well, then that's a big deal. So if those things don't happen, then, you know, we could avoid war. And I'm with you. I think then Robert's out of luck. So. Mm-hmm.
Then I think a coup does happen, and I think it's pretty decent. Either I don't know if Reagan can kill him or if they can just great counsel him out of it. You know, kind of like a board of trustees situation where the board finally, you know, just like a CEO's out.
Yeah. Right. Kind of a thing, so. Yeah. Okay. That's a good one though, Sir Robert. I mean, that's a interesting one to kind of think about as to whether I think he makes a really good point that if Rhaegar is king and he has the full Kingsguard around him and his commanders and stuff, you know, and then he's sort of also aligned with Dorne, you know, there's really no deposing him, I feel like, unless he's really pissed off the North and you have, again, the North and Robert kind of joining forces against Rhaegar, then that it could happen. But I also think Tywin, though, and late Lord Frey, who shows up super late, I think some of these other people would, because the Freys are just looking for a piece of the pie, you know, a piece of the pie. And yeah, so would have been very different if he was on the throne, if Rhaegar would have actually taken over. So, all right. I think that's it for Senda Raven there. So we have a bunch more that we've stockpiled, and we're going to be talking about those on our Fallout Friday episode. So we'll get to all of those. We got a bunch actually that we're sending at the end of last week. So that's awesome. You guys continue to send those to btkcast@gmail.com. On to Man the Wall. Basically just a place where we kind of plug our Patreon. We have extra episodes there. We've got t-shirts. We've got a place where you can kind of submit your name. We'll make you a custom sigil and have you kind of join our community there.
Yeah, and we've had a handful of new patrons. So if you are a new patron, just make sure to either send us an email or hit us up on the Facebook page. You can like message us, so we can get that sigil going for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And as they come in here, we're going to be sending out those t-shirts and stuff. But we have the Black Council you guys can kind of take a look at. We've got some other really cool just discussions and episodes. I think Sir Matt and I are excited to kind of start the Hedge Knight up again. And so we're looking forward to that for sure. So you can check all of that out at patreon.com/ bend the knee. So,
all right, Sir Ezra, I think it's time to sign off here. As always, we want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing Chapter 30, Eddard 7.
Yeah. If you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com.
We will see you in a week, and remember that winter is coming.